From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The biggest challenge for the re-election prospects for President Obama is a tepid economic recovery. But in Utah, the economy is one of Governor Gary Herbert's main selling points in his bid to be re-elected. The governor often talks about the Forbes magazine article that lists Utah as the best state for business. He talks about an unemployment rate below the national average and a job growth rate outpacing neighboring states. But his opponent in the race, Democrat Peter Cook, has questioned the relative quality of Utah's economy. It's one of the issues we'll talk to the governor about today as we complete our series of conversations with some of the candidates running for office in Utah this year. Governor Herbert will join us at the Hinckley Institute of Politics to talk about the economy, but also education, the environment, among other issues. We invite you to join us as well after this news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Governor Gary Herbert first came to his position when John Huntsman stepped down to take a job in the Obama administration. And it must have been at least a little challenging knowing how much of his job was fulfilling Huntsman's agenda and how much was creating his own. Well, the governor doesn't have to worry about that question anymore. In 2010, he was elected to the position, and now he has his own record to run on as he seeks his first full term of office. The governor is running against Democrat Peter Cook, and today in the program, he's joining us at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. It's the last in our series of conversations with some of the candidates running for office, and we invite you to join us today. We should say we don't have the ability to take your calls, but you can send questions via email. Our address is radiowest@kuer.org, and we'll also give those of you with us here at the University of Utah an opportunity to ask questions a little bit later in the program. Republican Gary Herbert was born and raised in Utah County. He made his career there in real estate. He served as a county commissioner for some 14 years, became Utah's governor in August of 2009, and Governor, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Doug. It's great to be with you.
I wonder if there was a particular thing that brought you first into public service. What was the thing that got you into public service at first?
Frustration. If you went back to the 80s, we had a very difficult time in real estate throughout the country. Our economy was in a very difficult time. Interest rates were at 16%. It's hard for us to even comprehend that today where we have interest rates so low.
Yeah.
But 16%, our prime rate was at 22%. And it seemed like government was doing everything to mess up the economy, doing everything just backwards. And so in frustration, I'd been involved in lobbying back in Washington, D.C. for private property rights, small business here on the Hill in Salt Lake City. And somebody challenged me that maybe you ought to do something more than just complain. And so I ran for office, and I got elected in 1990 as Utah County Commissioner based on what can we do to improve the economy. And it's kind of like deja vu when I took over as governor, is what can I do to improve the economy? And that's been my focus, and it's been laser-like in what we can do in Utah to turn around the economy after we're going through the most devastating economic downturn in our state's history since the Great Depression.
Yeah, I want to get to some particulars about your economic vision for the state. I wonder, though, did you expect at all that your career would take this direction? Are you surprised that you ended up as governor of the state, for example?
Yes, and so was my mother. And it's been what I would call an improbable journey. It says a lot about our country and about our state that anybody can really, literally grow up to become governor or become president. It's a remarkable system that gives us all great opportunities. And sometimes you don't know what's behind the next turn in the road and behind the next door that may open as one other door closes.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I kind of pinch myself and think, I am the governor of the greatest state in America. And it's been something that people have known me would know that I've never aspired to. It just kind of happened, and we took advantages of opportunity. You have to have some initiative and some get up and go. Again, it's been a humbling experience in many ways and very gratifying in others.
I wonder, I don't mean to get too personal here, Governor, but I wonder if you had one of those experiences in your life that changed you in an important way, that you can think of anything that really was transformational maybe even in some way.
Well, I don't know that there's a lot of things or one single thing that transforms people. I think it's a culmination of many things in life, whether it's your religion and an embracement of faith, marriage, raising children, and the challenges of having teenagers in the household. I served in the military during the Vietnam War, a period of time, which certainly had an impact on my view of the world and my appreciation for freedom. My father served during Korea.
Can I stop you there? How did that influence the way you saw the world, Vietnam?
Well, again, the disruption and the division of our country during the Vietnam War was pretty remarkable. And I didn't serve in combat. I served 6 years in the Utah Army National Guard, but you didn't go through airports with your uniform, and you had people that were very angry about the Vietnam War. Some good things came out of it, by the way. For example, that we reduced the voting age from 21 to 18. And we in the military were saying, and I agreed with this, that if you're old enough to go and fight and die, then you ought to be old enough to vote for those who send you into harm's way. And so we had a constitutional change in 1971 to reduce the age from 21 to 18.
Yeah.
I think the idea of being involved and shaping policy and the fact that we live in a democratic republic probably came through that difficult time in our country's history and for me, and the desire to be involved. And frankly, I made a commitment myself back in those days that I would never miss voting, at least as a bare minimum. I was going to participate and at least show up and vote. And I'm proud to tell you I've never missed voting, ever. And that was a commitment I made during that Vietnam War era. And as I turned 21 and had to do some absentee voting in order to vote, but I've never missed voting.
I referred to this in the introduction, and I do wonder if in those first years after Governor Huntsman stepped down, if you felt like you had to let some of his policies play out before you developed some of your own. Was that a hard position to be in at first, do you think?
No, in fact, it wasn't. Huh. And part of the reason it wasn't is because the Huntsman policies were Huntsman Herbert policies.
Yeah.
And so we worked together as a team. We'd campaigned against each other. As you recall, we were both running for governor in 2004.
Yeah.
And there were seven or eight of us. And as we eventually came together and we determined that maybe we would be a team and a partnership and maybe we'd get more things done that way, working together than working in opposition.
What influence do you think you had on the team? I mean, I guess the sort of knee-jerk impression is that Gary Herbert was a significantly more conservative man than John Huntsman. I mean, I wonder if you think that's necessarily true, I guess. And what was your influence in the Huntsman-Herbert team?
Well, I may have been a little more conservative, but again, it's a team.
Yeah.
And so the policies that we developed, again, with Governor Huntsman at the top of the ticket, were Huntsman-Herbert, policies that we worked on together. But Huntsman was a lot more conservative than some people give him credit for. We let out on tax reform and cut taxes. He was the first governor to support vouchers in the state of Utah and signed the bill for vouchers. So we did some really traditionally conservative things. And so it was not hard to change or to embrace the agenda that we'd worked on together. And so continuing on that course was not a hard thing to do. Plus, I came very well prepared. I didn't have as steep a learning curve as most people would be when they come into governor's office because I'd spent most of my life in the private sector. I understood free markets and free enterprise and capitalism.
Yeah.
And then I'd spent 14 years as a local government official where the rubber really does meet the road. And some of the heavy lifting is being done. Then I served for 4.5 years as a lieutenant governor, which you can't find a better training ground. And credit Governor Huntsman. He said, we want to have a team effort here, not just have the lieutenant governor kind of another pretty face to go to funerals and bar mitzvahs and other celebratory functions, but let's have you an active part. And so I had transportation responsibilities. I had homeland security. I had liaison work with the local governments. Rural affairs, public land issues, water development. That, along with my statutory requirements as a lieutenant governor, being a chief elections officer, and the things that are incumbent upon me with the statutory requirements. So when he decided to go to China and I needed to step up. I'd had a very significant training and background, so I was able to hit the ground running without really even missing a beat.
I wanted to talk about how you see your relationship with the legislature. Last year, you vetoed four bills coming from the legislature. You vetoed two bills this year, among them a controversial sex education bill. How do you describe your relationship with you? It doesn't sound like there was a lot of dissension there, but there were moments when you had to offer some pushback.
Well, we refer to it as healthy tension.
Right.
And there is a tension between the legislative branch and the executive branch. We have separate responsibilities. In some ways, I'm a check and balance. And I execute the laws as they create them and execute policy as they make them through the executive branch. And so we have different responsibilities. That being said, I've known them for a long time. I started working with them when I was a county commissioner and heightened the involvement when I was lieutenant governor. My belief is that we can shape policy by being a little more proactive in the beginning, not being too heavy-handed about it. But rather than veto a bill, why don't we get it shaped right in the first place so that when it gets through the process and comes out as legislation, that's something I already support. And we've done that very well in trying to navigate those waters. And consequently, we have not had to veto too many bills. But we will veto, as we've proven, when we think that there's a policy or legislation that's being created, which is wrong.
I want to talk about the economy. During this campaign, you've been talking about the relative health of the state's economy. But I wonder, is there anything that you worry about, any aspects of the economy that you see structurally or however that concern you?
Well, I'm concerned that there are people out there that still don't have jobs and that are out of work and would like to find a job. So as I've said when I was inaugurated, my focus was going to be on growing the economy and turning it around and providing economic opportunity for everybody. And we've done that by creating an environment that's conducive to the entrepreneur, for the business person to actually create wealth, which in turn creates jobs.
How do you do that?
We've reduced our tax rates. We have competitive tax rates. We've kept them so that they are lower. Other states have raised their taxes and has had devastating effect. I'll just point out my good friend Pat Quinn in Illinois. They had gaps and problems because of the recession, so they decided to raise taxes. And you can go to the actual date on the calendar when they imposed the tax increase, and over the next 6 months they lost 100,000 jobs.
So directly related to that.
There's a cause and effect, and you'll see people are fleeing California because of the raising of taxes. New York, again, Michigan, the challenge they've had because of the bad tax policy. We've had a competitive tax policy, and our tax policies have provided now that we've created over the last few years have allowed us to be in the top 10 best tax-friendly states in America. That's conducive for the business environment, for people who want to grow businesses and put their money, their resources, their risk that comes with a potential reward in a free market system. We've also done regulation reform. In fact, we sometimes think in terms of taxes and forget the regulatory environment that makes it very difficult for businesses to succeed. It's confusing. Sometimes they are contradictory. Again, you look at, again, a California, not to pick on our friends on the West Coast. But, again, the business people there say, we don't even know what the rules are to play by them. And we're looking for a more friendly environment like Utah. And you see a lot of companies, whether it be Adobe or Oracle or eBay or Microsoft or a Procter & Gamble or a Boeing, that are coming to Utah to expand their businesses, not staying in their home states because they like the environment here in Utah. But we also know that in order to continue that effort, education has got to be a key issue. Yeah. My number one budget priority since I've taken office has been education, raising the bar and making sure that we have a skilled labor force that lines up with the demands of the marketplace. If those three things can happen, where you've got a good environment for business with competitive taxes, regulatory reform, and a labor that's a force that's skilled, you will have economic opportunity. It's a fertile field for the entrepreneur to drop their seeds of business and grow a crop here in Utah. And that's why we've been recognized by so many different publications as the best place now in America to do business.
General Cook has raised a couple of questions about the relative health of the economy, and I wanted to get you to respond to some of those. And according to research by economists here at the University of Utah, the state's median income levels are dropping.
In fact, in 2010, the median income was $1,000 less than it was in 1997. Do you recognize that as a problem? How do you explain that, I suppose?
Well, not knowing all the numbers and the data, it sometimes is hard to compare apples with apples. We have a larger family size, and that has a lot to do with our household income compared to our per capita income. We've been listed lowest in one of the lower ones in the nation in per capita income, but that's because we have larger family sizes. So you divide more people into the household income. If you go to household income, which I think is a more reflective comparison, you'll find that we're at the upper end of income.
But it's stagnated. It's stopped since 1997.
Well,
median income in Utah.
Again, I don't know about 1997, and I can't.
Well, you hear that from General Cook.
I know, but I hear a lot of things from General Cook. Where this is silly season. They say they find a wart and they want to magnify
it. But you don't buy that. You don't buy
it. I believe that we've come through the worst economic downturn in the history of our state since the Great Depression.
Yeah.
And so we've had a loss of income. We've had a loss of jobs. We have fewer people employed, and consequently, you'll have a loss of median household income and per capita income. The good news is even General Cook recognizes we're recovering. He doesn't want to emphasize that, but if you go over the last 2 years based on the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you'll find that a year ago we had a 4.9% increase in personal income, which was the fifth highest, by the way, in the nation. And this last year was a 4.8% income increase in personal income. Again, one of the highest in the nation. So we've gone through this trough. We've dropped down. We're coming back up the other side. And the latest numbers that we have is that if you look over – again, I'm only responsible for when I've been in office. We've had over – since I've been in office, a 2% plus growth in employment and job creation that we've had here in Utah. We've been one of the top 10. We've been as high as the second best. We've been as low as the 10th. I mean, that's still pretty good. And as far as job growth creation in America. So we're coming back out. The latest Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce statistics show that the last 4 months we've had 3%, 3.2%, and 3.6% and 3.6% growth in the economy, which is really remarkable when you think that our historic growth rates have been 3.1%. So we are clearly on the right road to recovery, and we want to increase our incomes. And
you're not worried about anything. You look at the picture and you say, this is headed where I want it to be. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is if there's something that you're looking at that you think needs a little tweaking or fine-tuning. Are you seeing anything at all like that?
It's like if we're having a journey and we're going to San Diego. We're not there yet,
yeah,
but we're on the right road going in the right direction. Every indicator we have out there shows improvement. For the 95,000 jobs we've lost since the Great Recession started, it looks like right now we've recovered virtually all of those jobs, and now we're starting into the net gain part. Personal income is up, growing again. Household income is growing again. Job creation is growing again. Unemployment is going down. And here's two very important factoids. This is what you're talking about with income is dropping is true all over the country. Again, that's why we call it the Great Recession. But right now for government assistance, for those who want food stamps, the last year we've dropped 3.1%. That's a good sign. We're having fewer people ask for food stamps. And for temporary assistance to needy families, which is the big welfare program we have, it's down 17.9%. So, again, indications are for those who are most vulnerable amongst us, things are getting better, and that's a good sign. So we're on the right road. We're going in the right direction. We're not to utopia yet, but we're going to get there.
You were mentioning taxes there earlier. The organization, the Utah Foundation, released a report which said that Utah's tax burden has, in fact, as you said, dropped from 12th highest in the country to 31st. So we're paying fewer taxes, which, of course, you've always said this is a good thing. But it does raise the question of whether there isn't room to raise some revenue among Utahns to pay for education, which is always seems to be wanting. During your tenure, the public education budget has grown from $3.1 to $3.2 billion. You check my numbers, Governor, see if I'm right. But per pupil spending has fallen by nearly $300 per student. So the question of – and Utahns, it seems, if you look at public opinion surveys, are willing to bear a little bit higher of a tax burden if, in fact, they think it will benefit education. What do you make of that?
Well, again, not knowing all of your numbers, I know I've checked with our Governor's Office of Planning and Budget.
Yeah.
And since I've been in office, we stopped any cuts from happening in public education. And they would argue that our per pupil spending has actually gone up. Certainly in total, the amount of money we're spending has gone up. We have a unique challenge in Utah because we have the highest birth rate in the nation.
Right.
We have 20% larger family sizes. You can just picture if we had a classroom of 30 and we took 20% out, we'd have a classroom of 24. Our per pupil spending would go up dramatically in that kind of a scenario. So we have a unique challenge here in Utah when it comes to per pupil spending. That being said, how do you fund education? There's only three ways we can do it. One, we can take from already resources that we have, which are finite numbers, and say we're going to reprioritize. We're going to take away from other programs and redirect that money into our education fund. Right now, our education fund is all comes from income tax. Under our Constitution, every dime, every dollar of income tax is earmarked for education, can't be spent on anything else.
Right.
So we're already spending about $3.3 billion. And 65% of our state budget is, in fact, earmarked for education. So we have a commitment there. If you take from other programs, it could be road construction, infrastructure, it could be health and human services, public safety, you could, in fact, put more money into education by taking from other programs. That's one way.
Yeah.
The second way is that you can raise taxes. We have people that advocate that.
Right.
I think General Cook, in fact, well, he won't tell you that. He says he's going to come up with $2.2 billion, which means he's going to take all of the general fund that we have and dump that into education, or you're forced to raise taxes. I think that would be very unwise to do because we have a growing economy, but it's still fragile out there. And to put a dampening effect of a tax increase, we'd have the same problem Chicago had. And you'd actually end up having less revenue, revenue.
But even if Utahns say they're willing to bear some increase in their tax rate.
You can always volunteer, Doug, if you want to send in more money.
Well, I'm just
we'll
mentioning
the donation.
People.
Again, but it's not a matter of people saying, oh, we have a lot of people say, yeah, if I knew it was going to education. You've got to look at the overall policy.
Okay.
The fact that you're willing to do that, but that means you're going to take money you would spend someplace else, and it may have a dampening effect on the economy. So
right.
You've got to think of the overall big picture, not just kind of short-term hopeful gain. We don't want to have long-term kill the goose that's laying the golden eggs, which is the economy, which brings us to the third way to do it.
Grow the economy.
And we're proving the theory that it works. We've created this fertile field. We've created economic opportunity. We're creating economic expansion. And last year, because of that, we put nearly $200 million of new money into education, both public and higher. Gave teachers salaries for the first time in 4 years. And this year, as we continue to expand the economy, we'll be able to do the same thing. That's how you pay the bills. You have a healthy, growing economy that gives you additional revenue to pay for the unique circumstances we face in Utah. By the way, those circumstances are unique and they are very real.
Yeah.
Again, I wish I could have a time like when Mike Levin was governor. We had no growth in student population and a healthy economy. My gosh, they were awash with money. But today we have a growth of – it's about 2% of student population. We've come out of this economic downturn that's been very difficult. We've lost $1 billion in revenue, and we've had to find ways to make tough decisions, survive. And by the way, we've never laid off any teachers. Other states are cutting teachers right and left. Higher education tuitions are going through the roof. We've been able to mitigate a lot of that here in Utah because we've turned the corner and are growing the economy. So, hey, it's not perfect. But by golly, compared to where we've been and compared to other states, this is an item of success in a sea of chaos out there across the country.
Do you think, let me just ask you this quickly before we head to a break, those unique limitations, unique challenges that Utah has always ends up in terms of per pupil funding, forgive me, 49, 50th, you know. Is there any getting out of that? Is there any moving that needle at all, acknowledging this simple reality?
Well, you hope if the economy continues to grow that we can actually make some steps in that direction. I know we concentrate on pupil funding, and it is about money. It is not all about the money, but it is certainly some about the money.
Right.
A more important area to concentrate on, though, is outcomes. What are we doing with the money? We're doing a lot better with our test scores and our achievement tests and our success of our students, our graduation rates, people involved in advanced placement courses, those that go on to college and university studies, into our applied technology colleges. We do much better than states are spending a lot more money per pupil. So that's what we ought to concentrate on. Can we get more money into the program? I think we can as we expand the economy, as we find more efficiencies, more technology, more opportunities for online schools, remote distance learning. There's a lot of things we're doing that's going to help us get a better bang for the buck. But at the end of the day, isn't it nice to know that in Utah, when you compare Utah's test scores on ACT test scoring with other states that have at least 50% of the people that take the ACT test, and we have about 73% that do it on a voluntary basis, we score the eighth highest in America. Our teachers are doing a pretty darn good job. And that's why we've created now in an effort to unite us and have not just a one-year plan, but an eight-year plan of what we call 66 by 2020. We have a united effort with the business community and Prosperity 2020, uniting the state together in ways we've not seen in years to say we're going to raise the bar when it comes to educational achievement in the state. By 2020, we want to see two-thirds of our adult population, ages 20 to 64, will have some kind of post-high school certificate, associate, or full degree in this state. It's going to, again, no pun intended, move us to the head of the class. And it's something that we're seeing a great success in and embracement. It's going to be a challenge, but it's something that we need to do and must do and will do.
Governor Gary Herbert is with us, the Republican incumbent, seeking his first full term as governor in Utah. We should mention we spoke with Democratic challenger Peter Cook last week as part of our Meet the Candidate series. We're here in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and you can join the conversation sending us an email, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are rounding out our series of conversations with some of the candidates running for office in Utah. Utah Governor Gary Herbert is our guest today here in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. We're on the campus of the University of Utah. It's the governor's first election for a full term. He was elected in a special election in 2010. He's facing Democrat Peter Cook. Governor, the outdoor industry association and the retailer trade shows, as you know, those twice yearly trade shows in the summer and the winter slips something like $40 million into the state's economy. And of course, they've had some concerns about Utah's environmental policies. Chief among them lately has been a bill that was passed at the legislature you signed that demands the federal government surrender some 30 million acres of public land back to the state. Do you at all worry about that as an issue? Do you regret at all ever signing that bill? And do you think it's going to have a negative effect on, in particular, this organization?
Well, I don't regret signing the bill. I think it was the right thing to do. I think Utah has been at kind of ground zero on public land debate for many, many years. It goes back to Governor Spry back in 1915. This has been a reoccurring theme. The state of Utah has felt like that the federal government has not kept its promises that were made at the time of statehood, and that's been part of the concern. The lack of what they felt we as Utahns feel like has been good federal management of the public lands as part of it too, and it bubbles up occasionally. We've had two Republicans county me that have been concerned about it, and we've had three Democrats. So it's been a bipartisan frustration over the history of our state. Bottom line on all this is, as I was with Congressman Bishop here just a week ago, we talked about the public land issues, and the statement we made is that Utah is a public land state. It will always be a public land state. The question is going to be, how can we optimize the management of the public lands for the good of Utah and all of America? And we are trying to take a reasoned and rational, balanced approach as per the BLM charter, the Bureau of Land Management, the Department of Interior.
But how does the, some would wonder whether or not a bill that on its face seems unconstitutional, asking the federal government to give this land back, represents a balanced or reasonable approach. You think it fits into that?
Absolutely, because part of the effort is to at least get their attention and say, you know, we're serious about this.
So it's not serious, it's an attention getter?
It is an attention getter, and we're getting their attention. And, you know, there's only three arrows in the quiver when it comes to public land policy. The first one and the preferable one is to negotiate. We've been trying to get their attention for a long time on RS-2477 roads and rights-of-way and how we can optimize the management of the public lands. It gets a little frustrating when we end up having capital leaves Utah and goes to North Dakota because it's mostly all private land. They had the same charter when they became a state that we did, and yet we have 70% public land. They have 9% public land. It creates a whole different dynamic for us. And so we would say to the federal government, let us help as a partner in how we find ways to optimize the public land. It's not one versus the other. It's finding a way to blend together in a balanced approach. We've been kind of ignored in that regard. So negotiation is the first thing. The next thing would be legislation. We end up getting a little bit sick and tired of administrations that try to go around the Congress and create wilderness designation. For example, the current administration last year created, out of the blue, no warning, what they called wild lands. Clearly an unconstitutional end run around the Congress. I had to go back in Congress and testify before a couple of committees on it. We had to file suit. And they did back off, thankfully. But that's the kind of concern we've got. You negotiate. We try to create legislation that's appropriate. And we did that down in Washington County with what's called the Washington County Lands Bill. But the last arrow in the quiver is litigation. Sometimes you cannot agree, even though you negotiate hard and in sincere and in good faith. And so ultimately you go to court. We filed a lawsuit on our roads, for example. Our RS-2477 roads of the state owns jointly with the counties. And we have a right to these roads. We have disagreement on what are roads and what are not. The reason that the part of the opposition of that is we don't want anything to be declared a road because then we can't declare a wilderness. So there are just some differences of opinion, but that's what courts are for, is to help sort that out. So we're going to use all three of those, negotiation, legislation, and litigation, as we see what is in the best interest of Utah and Utah's future.
What are you willing to compromise? You're talking about – I mean, it's a give and take, I understand. What are the areas where you see you'd be willing to compromise some of your positions in favor of the environmental concerns?
Well, again, we think that there are areas that ought to be, in fact, set aside. As we're working with the outdoor retailers and the outdoor industry, we recognize that there are places that should be kept pristine. Even the bill that's been controversial and I think distorted in its intent by the opposition exempts out the 5 national parks. It exempts out the monuments. It exempts out the 33 wilderness areas. And it requires a commission to be created that will say, let's look and bring all the stakeholders together and identify what other areas ought to be set aside as some of the jewels and the gems of the state. But let's find a way to in fact, access our natural resources in reasonable, rational, responsible ways as good stewards of the earth. Let's find ways to manage our forests. Let's find ways to spray for the bark beetle, for heaven's sake, so we don't lose the forest. We've lost a complete lumber industry in Utah because the federal government won't let us spray for the bark beetle, and all we've created is a fire hazard out there. So there's a better way to optimize the use of the public lands, and I just think that Utah, it's our backyard, and we understand it probably pretty well, and maybe better than many, and we ought to be have our ability to give input with the federal government as we jointly manage the lands.
Let me take a few questions from those of us here in the audience. And I should mention that question about federal land. I have a pile of questions here from Amy in Salt Lake and Amy also in Salt Lake and Eric and Megan. A lot of questions related to that. So people are concerned about that question of federal land.
And legitimately so. Yeah. It's a big issue. It's a little bit complicated. And again, it doesn't lend itself to political sound bites and billboards. And so there's a lot of misunderstanding and distortion out there. Believe me, when I brought in Ted Wilson, our leading environmentalist, and I said, Ted, let's see if we can't come together on this issue, and let's see if we can find a balanced approach. In fact, the commission he chairs and challenges today is the Balanced Resource Commission. We're trying to find a balanced way to deal with our 70% of our public land. And I think we can actually have some successes in that regard. And again, I think our outdoor retailers, frankly, agree with that. We're working with them, too, by the way. It's probably a distortion to think that they're going to move out of Utah because of our public land discussions we've had for generations. Yeah. More likely, they would leave because they don't have enough bed space or display space in Salt Lake as this outdoor retailer convention has grown so rapidly.
Yeah. Let me get to some of the questions here. Amber is with us.
In the wake of Hurricane Sandy, I would like to know your position as a governor in regards to federal funding and assistance. Excuse me. So Romney has stated that he feels the responsibility should fall on the states for both the financial burden as well as the recovery. And I'd like to know, as a governor, how you feel about FEMA's role with the states.
Well, FEMA has a significant role to play. FEMA acts like an insurance company, and we have a lot of different natural disasters that take place and other kind of disasters around the country. And as taxpayers, as we pay into that program, the FEMA has a role to play to help us. Mainly it's in paying bills. As we've seen what's happened with Hurricane Katrina and Rita, we're seeing what's happened with Hurricane Sandy. As we see what's happened here in our own state with our own flooding and fires and natural disasters that we've had here, the first responders are the local governments, our cities, our public safety of the cities, our public safety of the counties, and the state comes in and helps facilitate and coordinate those efforts. The federal government comes in last, as they assess that and help pay for some of the costs that are involved in the losses, particularly for public properties. That's their role to play. That being said, states need to take a more active role. When I was lieutenant governor, we created in Utah, after I'd visited my friend Mitch Landrieu, who's the lieutenant governor in Louisiana, and flew over Hurricane Katrina's devastation in New Orleans and looked at that, we came back and created what's called the Be Ready Utah program, meaning that we all have a responsibility to be ready, individuals, families, local communities, and we've got that. In fact, we have a BeReadyUtah.gov webpage where you can look at the steps we've recommended people to take to be prepared for. People say, what? And I say, fill in the blank, whatever the disaster will be. And states need to step up and be ready. But we have a federal program which is designed like an insurance company. We put into it, and we get money back to help us defray some of those costs.
I guess the question is, the sort of broader question is the role of the proper role of the federal government. In this year's State of the State address, you said Utah will not capitulate to a federal government that refuses to be constrained by its proper and constitutionally limited role. So what is the role of the state? What is the role of the federal government? The Salt Lake Tribune reported in January that since you'd taken office, federal funding to the state had grown by more than $1 billion, and that in your proposed budget for the fiscal year, I think, of 2013, federal money made up nearly 28% of that, some $3.5 billion. So I guess some people see a contradiction in you saying that there should be limited federal role, yet you're willing to take the money. How do you respond to that?
Well, we take money that we have to pay back. You know, it's not wise for us to say, look, we're not going to take money that are given to for good and appropriate purposes and say, well, we won't take it. They pay it out to somebody else, and we still have to pay back the bill. I've asked the federal government on some – when we had stimulus money that came in to the state of Utah, will you give our taxpayers a tax credit? We won't take the money. We can get by. It's going to be tough. We'll make the cuts and the necessary adjustments. But give our taxpayers a tax credit then so they don't have to pay it back. Nope. You don't take it, you're still going to have to pay it back anyway. Well, that didn't make any sense either. It's a federal responsibility to balance a budget, and we all ought to be concerned about the fact that 40 cents out of every dollar being spent in Washington, D.C. is borrowed money. That's not sustainable. So I agree. States need to not go hat in hand, and Utah is not. We have a lot of federal money that comes in our state because we have a lot of federal land that's involved in our state. We're trying to find a more balanced approach. I've gone back and testified twice before Congress and said, we'll take 20% less money from you. We'll help you balance your budget. Just take away the strings. Block grant the money to us. We're pretty smart people in Utah. We can figure ways to get better bang for the buck, and we're doing it. In Utah, we have less employees today in state government than we had clear back into the year 2000. And yet we've got 600,000 more people in Utah that call Utah home. We literally are doing more with less. Contrast that with Washington, D.C., which is doing less with more. They've had an increase in labor of 13% over the last 3.5 years. While we're cutting, they're increasing. We're doing more and better. They're doing less and worse.
You asked a team of attorneys to look at the agreement worked out between Utah and Nevada over dividing water rights in the Snake Valley. And apparently they told you this week that it is an equitable agreement, but it's, of course, opposed by local officials in Millard County and Salt Lake County, as well as some environmental groups. Do you, Governor, plan to sign the agreement? And if not, how do you plan to deal with that Snake Valley water issue?
Well, it's yet to be determined whether I will sign this agreement or not.
You're undecided right now.
Yeah, that's why we're having people review it. There's been an ongoing negotiation. It goes back to the days of Governor Huntsman. That's how long this has been an ongoing issue. I've taken the position that, one, we will not give up any water that belongs to Utah. We will protect every molecule of H2O. Two, we want to make sure that when we do this, that we protect the water rights of those that already exist. We have a number of ranchers and farmers out there on the Snake Valley area that already have wells and irrigation water rights out there that they want to preserve and protect. And thirdly, we want to make sure that whatever we do protects the environment. It's that simple to me. Now, we can sit back and do nothing and hope things work out. You've got Senator Harry Reid, who's already said, we're going to build a pipeline up through the BLM and pass legislation through the Congress allowing that to happen. We cannot control the pipeline. There's a misunderstanding that somehow that we can stop that pipeline from happening. That's a Nevada water decision with the Enabling Act of Senator Harry Reid, a Democrat in Nevada. They're going to put the pipeline up there. The best we can do is to make sure we can protect ourselves, and an agreement probably will do that. Whether this is the right agreement remains to be seen. But if you care about the environment, you want to have some protections in place. If you care about water rights, you want to have some protections in place. If you care about the people already are out there, you want to have some protections in place. Because if we don't do anything, the recourse will be eventually there'll be degradation of the environment out there. Then we'll have to go to court and we'll sue for redress. But we have to wait for degradation and damage to occur. That may take 10, 15, or 20 years before we could get into court. Then the damage is done. So I think we ought to be at least proactive on this thing and not wait, sit back and say, I hope everything works out. So that's why we're having some hard negotiations, and we're going to have a public hearing on it through the legislature to get input. Anybody who has a concern, pro or con, can speak. And then after I've got all that input, then I'm going to have to make a tough decision.
Let's go back to the audience. Steve Cruz from the Utah Foundation. Go ahead.
Governor, good morning.
Good morning.
As I understand it, you can run again in 2016. What are your thoughts about another term that would go out to 2020 and maybe about term limits in general?
You know, I'm still worried about next Tuesday. I'll get through this next Tuesday, and if I'm fortunate enough to get reelected, then sometime in the next 4 years, I'll make a determination on whether I should run again or not. I certainly am not going to rule out running again in 2016, but it is way too early to make that kind of a decision.
Courtney is with us here somewhere. Yeah, hold on. Wait for that microphone. Great. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Courtney Badome, and I'm a first-year student here, and I'll let you read my question because I worded it pretty good on the note.
Okay. Here's Courtney's well-worded question. She wants to know, are you working with Congress to keep Pell Air Force Base open? And it's well-worded, but not so – the handwriting I can't read, and that's my fault. Courtney, I'm sorry. She says, Hill Air Force Base is critical to Utah's economy and is on the list of bases to possibly be closed. What are you – how are you thinking about all of that?
And we'll give Courtney an A for her language composition and a C-plus on her writing skills. Hill Air Force Base is certainly a very valuable part of our economy in Utah. I've always believed that Hill Air Force Base is a tremendous asset that should stand on the three issues of keeping it open based on these three things. One, it's in the best interest of our national defense. Two, it's in the best interest of the Air Force. And three, it's in the best interest of the taxpayer. It ought not to be so parochial that we say, oh, because we have jobs there and the government is overspending its budget, that we ought to keep it open because it's jobs in Utah. I mean, that's a nice byproduct of it, but it ought to be because it is in the best interest of the taxpayer, national defense. and the Air Force. And I believe it is, by the way. And that message needs to get out. And so we have what's called the Utah Defense Alliance, which I put in the budget this last year, $500,000 to help them in messaging with those who have that responsibility. We work hand in glove with our congressional delegation to, again, to make the get the message out. And I also sit on a what's called a Western Partnership, Western Regional Partnership, with a guy named John Conger, who's the Undersecretary Deputy of Defense. Which is our job. I'm the co-chair of that. Our responsibility is to maintain the military bases here in the West, as I'm the chairman of the Western Governors Association. So we're having direct communication with those who are involved in making decisions. It doesn't look like there'll be any kind of a BRAC proposal until 2014, so I think we don't have to worry at least until then. And even then, I believe that we, the men and women out there at Hill Air Force Base, have got a great product. And it is in the best interest of America and the taxpayers to keep that base open and solvent.
Here's an email from Gary, who writes from Salt Lake. Utah has often been criticized for its lack of urban planning. How do you respond to the accusation that you've been more concerned about meeting the needs of the real estate lobby than in meeting the needs of Utah residents and commuters who are suffering from the extreme lack of such planning?
Well, I don't think history bears that out. I know it's easy to target me because I happen to come from the real estate industry myself as a former real estate broker and developer. But I'm a free market person. That being said, I'm also the original vice chairman or one of the vice chairmen of Envision Utah, which is designed to plan ahead and anticipate growth. Working with particularly the 10 counties along the Wasatch Front and back with Envision Utah, where we've actually tried to give tools to the local communities to prepare for growth that's certainly going to occur, and it has. And in fact, I leave this broadcast here today and go to an Envision Utah meeting where we, in fact, talk about those who are out there on the front lines planning and preparing for the growth pressures. I also help create the legislation for what's called the Quality Growth Commission, which encompasses all of Utah. Again, designing and preparing local communities and setting aside critical lands that need preservation in our state. We've set aside many, many tracts of land throughout the state in rural and urban areas to be set aside for non-development as part of our Quality Growth Commission. So I think we've had a very good balanced approach in land development here in the state of Utah. And particularly for a state that has, you know, so little private property.
Yeah.
Again, keep in mind, we're not like other states. I'm not saying it's good or bad. It just is what it is. We have less than 25% of our landmass in the state of Utah that's privately owned property. That's small.
You also have the situation where, of course, the state and in particular urban areas are growing. What do you how do you think about air quality? What is to be done in particular about air quality? What's your vision for that?
Well, all of us want to have clean air and clean water. I think we all ought to talk in terms of being good stewards of the earth. And if we make a mess, we ought to clean it up. Again, there's a balanced way to do things. We have some that would shut down any kind of extractive operation in our state. They just don't want it. Now, our energy costs would go through the roof and our economy would tank, but nevertheless, if we were all walking or riding bikes, that would be okay with some of them. Others want to develop every square foot. And, you know, both extremes are incorrect. We need to find a balanced way to address it. Everybody has a responsibility when it comes to the environment. And we've had some created what we call the UCARE program. It comes out of my office. We in the state have our own requirements for those with our automobile fleet. We have some compressed natural gas automobiles as well as regular gas-powered petroleum automobiles, but we have an idling restriction so people don't out and idle. We trip chain. We use mass transit. Again, trying to do our part as a state by leading by example. We've asked other in the industry. Some of it's mandatory, and some of it we're trying to get them to do more by voluntary means. But all of us have a role to play if we try to clean up the air and the environment we live in. It's not only just good sense, because it does have health consequences, but it's also good for the economy. If we get air that's not clean, we'll end up restricting our ability for the economy to grow. By the way, I've been out the Uinta Basin. We spent $4 million for an airshed study out in the Uinta Basin. I was just up in Cache County, meeting with the county council up there, seeing what we can do for their air quality challenges. And, of course, here in the Wasatch Front, it's been a constant challenge. But we're making some headway. The good news for all of us is the air is cleaner today than it was 20 years ago. And in Lowell, it's cleaner than it was 40 years ago. So the air is getting cleaner. We have the compounding problem of increased population, so we need to do more. We have to run just to keep up. But the good news is the air is cleaner than it has been in a generation ago.
We're running out of time. I wanted to get to this question about radioactive waste. Why did you nominate Dan Schramm to the Utah Radiation Control Board? He, for those who don't know, is a company executive with Energy Solutions. There's been some controversy about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the answer is he's the only one applied for the job. We have a statute that says that you have to have somebody from the industry that sits on the board. That's part of the makeup of the commission. And so he's the only one who applied for the job, so we didn't have a lot of choice.
You couldn't have gone out and sought someone?
Well, we could have, but again, you have people that apply for jobs. You have recommendations come in. It just turned out that he was the only one that qualified that applied for the job. We've since have said, you know, maybe we need to change the statute. That's what's come out of this,
sure.
And so we're looking at that. And we've also said maybe we need to bring somebody in from out of state. I support the concept of having somebody from the industry that regulates an industry. I mean, we do it in many others. This is only – the reason this is controversial is because we only have one that stores low-level Class A waste.
Right.
And so they're unique in that regard. But we have people from the farm industry, the turkey industry, that sit on turkey review boards and commissions out there. You want to have somebody that knows the industry. It's not a bad thing. And so there's been more made out of this than probably is warranted. But that was the statute, and that's who applied for the job. We didn't have any choice.
About a minute left. Let me ask you, what's your biggest worry, the thing you worry about for this state right now the most?
Well, I don't worry about anything about the state from the standpoint of our future. I am very, very optimistic about Utah. I don't think Utah is really like cream rising to the top when it comes to states out there. We're doing so many good things in so many good ways. We're not perfect. We certainly have challenges out there. But I'm very optimistic. Our economy's turned around. We're raising the bar in education. We have a 10-year energy plan that brings balance to the needs in conjunction with our public land unique challenges. We're putting infrastructure in place that will accommodate the growth pressures of the second fastest growing state in America. We're putting together water conferences to make sure that we have adequate water, which is the only limiting factor for our growth in the state.
Really, no worries.
I don't have any worries. I accept that there's challenges out there.
Yeah.
I'm a very optimistic guy based on what I see out there. It's not just Pollyanna, pie in the sky, head in the sand stuff. The data shows we're doing some good things. We have the challenge of growth, which is probably our biggest challenge, because people are going to be coming to Utah because we have job opportunities, we have economic potential, and we have the best quality of life of all of America. So this, the growth aspects is probably our biggest challenge we face going forward. But I'm extremely optimistic about Utah's future.
Republican Governor Gary Herbert. Governor, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug.
And we should mention we spoke with Democratic challenger Peter Cook last week. You can go to our website to hear that conversation. Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks, of course, to everyone here at the Hinckley Institute of Politics for hosting the series. Our program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark, mixed by our engineer Lewis Downey. I'm Doug Fabrizio.